Good morning. Welcome to Crossroads. My name is Steve. I appreciate you coming to our egg hunt. And we have a few preliminaries before that, like a sermon and stuff. So we're looking at this incredible story. I love stories. Darlene and I like to go to movies. And, you know, we notice that great stories have a lot of action and they have emotion. And the greatest ones of all, I love the ones that are actually true. The ones that it's like, okay, this thing happened and these people existed and they got the pictures of them and all that. So this is a story. It's a wonderful story. It's the greatest story ever told, but it's also true. It's absolutely true. And in fact, I think we'll find that our response to this story will define our lives. That's a big statement. But I'll come back to it. Let me give you a little background. We're celebrating something that happened on a Sunday, but the previous week went like this. Two Saturdays before, Jesus went to a dinner nearby at the home of a guy who used to be a leper. His name was Simon, and he'd been healed. And then there was this dinner, and Martha served, and Mary. That's when she took this giant vial of ointment, and it cost a lot, like a year's wages, and she poured it all over Jesus just to anoint him. And that was Saturday. And then the next day, Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey. And the whole city was like celebrating, this is our king. But that kind of died down. And so that afternoon, and then Monday and Tuesday, he taught in the temple area and up on the Mount of Olives, talked about the future. And then Wednesday, nothing happened that we know of. There's no account of anything happening on Wednesday in the New Testament. Thursday was the day that he got his disciples together, found a place where they could have dinner, celebrated the Passover dinner with them. He washed their feet. He told them to love one another. And then after that, they went out into the night onto the Garden of Gethsemane, where he was captured and he was imprisoned. And he went through six crazy trials that night. And finally, he was brought before Pilate. He was mocked. He was brutalized. And he was crucified on Friday. He died. And he was buried. And that Friday night, imagine if you were one of his followers, you're thinking, I didn't expect this. Even though throughout his ministry, Jesus was often saying, I'm going to die, and I'm going to die in an unusual way, and then I'm going to come back after 3 days. He would say that over and over again, but people just didn't quite get it. It's like they couldn't see it. They weren't ready. They were like in denial. And so that Saturday is a day in which there's just silence. Nothing's going on. And for his followers, they're probably thinking, this is the first day of the rest of my life. My whole life is going to be like this, discouragement and depression, disillusionment. Can't believe this is happening. And they're just, they've got confusion, grief, and then Sunday. And it's like they would go to take flowers to a grave. And here Mary shows up. And as I'm reading this story this last week, I started thinking, I've read this many times and maybe it's familiar to you. But four words kind of exploded off the page to me. And I wanted to walk through these four images. And there are these four words, running, crying, seeing, and believing. As I read over this story that Darlene just read from John 20, those are the words that I want to really focus upon. Running, crying, seeing, and believing. It says on the first day of the week, early on the first day of the week. It doesn't say the third day, although it was the third day. It says early on Sunday. You know, we think of this as at the end of the weekend, right? But it's really the first day of the week. It's the first day of the real rest of their lives. And early that day, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene goes to the tomb and sees that the stone has been removed from the entrance. Excuse me. So she came running to Simon Peter. I'm going to get this water real quick. Just talk amongst yourselves. Everybody in the story is running. Have you noticed that? She runs. She runs to the two leaders of the disciples, Peter and John. She gets them, and then they take off running. Peter and the other disciple. John doesn't say his name, but that's who it is. When he says the other disciple who Jesus loved, it's John. And he is he's the one writing this book. He's John the Apostle. And so they're running. both of them, verse 4, and the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. One of my favorite paintings is by a little-known artist named Eugene Bernand. We went to Paris several years ago, and we were at the D'Orsay Museum, and we turned a corner, and I saw this beautiful painting. To me, it just captures the whole picture of what they were feeling. They're running to the tomb. This is John on the left and Peter on the right. And you can just see in their faces the desperation of running to find out what in the world is this woman talking about. People don't run much in real life. Have you noticed that? Kids run. You know that a kid is awake if they're running, right? They're always running. And adults, we run because we live sedentary lives and we have to get some exercise, right? But adults, grown-ups, by and large, don't run, right? It's not dignified. It's not presidential. You never see like a president running around, right? And we're always in charge. That's the whole point of growing up, is to be in charge of our lives and nothing bothers us unless something's really, really important, unless there's some danger or something goes wrong, right? Unless you're at the playground and your kid falls off the jungle gym and then you run like crazy to your kid. Or 9/11, the towers fall in New York City. I had a friend who walked out of one of the towers with a Starbucks cup in his hand. He looked up and the plane hit and he started to run. You run when things are really, really desperate or really important. Or your dad is off at war. He's on deployment. And surprise, surprise, your dad comes home for a visit. You don't walk, you run, right? Can you imagine God running? You think, well, that's not very God-like. You know, God's in control of everything. Why would he be in a hurry? Why would he want to run? I love the fact that Jesus was trying to get us, often in his teaching, to understand who God is, because we have this warped idea of who God is. We don't quite get him. So in Luke 15, Jesus tells three stories to explain to us who God is and what he's like. He said, God is like someone who's looking for a lost sheep, or God is like someone who's looking for a lost coin, and they put all their effort into looking for this lost thing. And then he says, imagine God is a father, and he's got two sons, and one of the sons never does anything wrong. He's always staying around the home, and the other son is just a mess, and he does everything wrong. Did I say that about the first one? First one does everything right. Second does everything wrong, goes off, wastes all his money, does all these crazy things, and then finally comes to his senses and going, I had a lot better back home. I don't know if I can go home now, but I'm going to try. So he turns for home, and he's off in the distance, and what does the father do? The father stands and goes, man, he's got a lot to pay for. I don't know if I'm even going to look at him. That's probably what he thought it would be like, right? I'm turning, I'm going home. Man, I'm in trouble. It says in Luke 15, while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son and he threw his arms around him and kissed him. Can you imagine God is like that? Maybe you want to turn back to God. Maybe you wonder if it's too late. Maybe you'll wonder if you can go back home to the Father, and you wonder what he's going to be like, and we have this sense in our heads that he's just angry with us, and he just doesn't want much to do. And this, though, is what God is really like. Jesus said, this is what the Father's like. This is the way he is. He runs to meet you. So there's action, there's running. The next thing is there's emotion. Mary is crying. She's not the only one that has emotion, but she's crying. Why is she crying? Well, Mary Magdalene is a woman who's far away from home, right? In those days, she is pretty far from the top of Israel to Jerusalem. She lived in Galilee. She came from a town called Magdala, which was just about 20 minutes walk from Tiberias, which is up there near Capernaum, which is where Jesus did all his miracles. She's in that area. And her life had been an absolute train wreck. I mean, everybody's messed up, right? But she is the kind of woman that people would look at and go, don't get anywhere near that woman, kids. She's crazy. She's probably, I don't know, stumbling around, mumbling. Why do I say this? Because she had seven demons. Now, I don't know how that manifested itself, but she's not a safe person to be around. Her life is an absolute chaotic train wreck. And somewhere along the line, she comes in contact with Jesus, and he heals her. And suddenly they're gone. I have no idea what that must feel like, to just have absolute horrific chaos day in and day out, hellish control over your life, and then suddenly you're free. And here's this teacher that has just given her life, and she just loved him. And now he's dead. And she's thinking, my chaotic life is probably going to come back. One commentator said, I believe that during that night, like Friday night, Saturday night, I believe that during that night, all hell got up and looked at Mary Magdalene. She probably thought, oh my, here we go. So she's grieving. Now, when you grieve, and maybe you're grieving something, you know, they've done studies that show that there are stages of grief, right? And that you go through this stage and this stage. There's probably about 20 stages, right? And you're thinking, well, start off at the left. I kind of go down, work my way back up, and it seems very orderly, and it all works together. But this is what we really experience. It's really like this, right? So those are the technical stages of grief, but this is our own lives, and that's where she was. That's Mary Magdalene. She's just thinking, oh, my God, what has happened? And here's this person, and now he's gone. What in the world is going to happen? Someone did a study of this and sees a pattern in these people that saw the resurrection. There's Mary, there's Peter, there's John, the other disciples, there's Thomas, remember him? He doesn't see him right away. He was missing from that meeting for some reason. And he says, I'm not believing until I see the very nail prints in his hands. And so the pattern is this. In each of the resurrection appearances, we discovered a pattern that, number one, the people are engulfed in a human emotion. She is full of grief. The disciples are full of fear. Thomas is full of doubt. But the second part of the pattern is the risen Christ appears to them in the midst of their condition. And number three, as a result, they're transformed. Now, there's a couple of things about this that I really love. Number one, God understands emotions. He has emotions. When one of his best friends died, you know, what do you think Jesus did? Did he say, hey, you know, don't worry about this, I got it. It's Lazarus. I'm going to bring him back from the grave. No, Jesus did bring him back from the grave, but before that, he looked at the situation and he broke down and wept. So God understands our emotions. He's got emotions himself. But he transforms us. And this is what's amazing to me as I was thinking about it this week, is that is it not enough for Jesus to come here, be born as a human baby, to live a life perfect, to serve everyone he meets, and then to be captured and mistreated and murdered, dies on a cross, the worst thing you can imagine, and then he rises again. I mean, if I was in control after that, I would like put him on a chair and just tell everybody to come up and like look at him and shake his hands, right? That hasn't he done enough? But then what he does is he goes to each person individually. He goes to Mary and deals with her in her emotional state. And then he goes to the disciples, and he goes to them in their emotional state, and then he goes to Thomas. He just keeps going. He just keeps serving every single individual, just like everybody in this room. It's the same gospel. It's the same Jesus, but he comes to each one of us in our situation, in our lives. He condescends constantly. I find that just astonishing that he would do that. So there's action, running, there's emotion, there's crying. The third thing is there's seeing. There's seeing something that actually happened, because Christianity is a historic faith. It means it's based on something that happened in history. It's not just a philosophy, it's not just a worldview, it's based on facts. And these are eyewitness accounts. So the word see or saw is really, really important. Christianity is certain things that happened at a point in time in history, and if they didn't, then it's gone. It's foolish if it didn't happen. So there's veracity, there's truth, there's authenticity. You've got a woman, Mary, is the first one to see Jesus and the first one to go to the tomb. And you know what? In that day, in the first century, a woman's testimony was inadmissible in court. So if you're making this up, you would never start it off with a woman being the first one. You just wouldn't do it unless that's what really happened. And so you've got Mary. What does she see? She sees this stone, which weighs like 1,000 pounds. And it was often in like a groove. But the word doesn't say that it was just pushed down the groove. It was lifted up. It was like lifted up and placed somewhere else. That's what she sees. She sees the empty tomb. And then Peter and John come, and what do they see? They see an empty tomb. They see some grave clothes. It's interesting that Peter looks in. You know, John gets there first, then Peter goes in. And he's looking, and the Greek word that's used for look is theoreo, which means like theory or like reasoning. And it's like Peter's looking at this situation, and he's going through all the options in his head. He's going, huh, the grave clothes are there, but they're all neatly laid out. And then you got this napkin that was wrapped around Jesus' head, and it's nicely folded. So if he got up and tore them all off, they'd be all over the place, right? But I know he was dead, so that doesn't work. Then he goes, well, maybe the authorities moved the body somewhere else. But they wouldn't unwrap it. Oh, maybe there was some thieves that got in here and somehow overpowered this Roman soldier guard of all these soldiers, that it's death penalty if you leave your post, but they just kick them out and they stole the body, but they wouldn't unwrap it and they wouldn't leave it nicely there. And Peter's seeing these things and he's reasoning through it and he's looking at it. So Christianity is based on things that actually happened. And if you'll notice, the gospel writers don't try to embellish it or hype it up. I was reading one commentary once by Leon Morris, who's a great New Testament scholar. And I was reading along and it says, the gospel writers do not praise Jesus. And I said, what? Wait a minute. That doesn't sound right. I went back and reread the line again. It doesn't say they didn't believe in him. He says, the gospel writers don't praise Jesus. They're not like cheerleaders, like trying to manipulate you into believing. The gospel writers don't praise Jesus. This I find very surprising. I should have thought that when men were writing about their master, that every now and then they would say how wonderful and good and perfect he was. But they don't. They just put down the facts and they let it go at that. Now you can go to the book of Psalms and it's talking about how wonderful God is. But the gospel writers, their purpose is to tell you what happened. They don't need to embellish it. They don't need to hype it up. It's true. In fact, it's so true that the Apostle Paul continues to say how important this is that people saw stuff. In 1 Corinthians 15, he says this. Jesus was seen after the resurrection by Peter, and then seen by the 12. And after that, he was seen by more than 500 followers at one time, most of whom are still alive. Like, you go look them up and ask them, although some have died. And then he was seen by James, and later by all the apostles. Last of all, I also saw him. This is something, it's not a theory, it's not a worldview, it's not a philosophy. It really matters whether Jesus really did rise from the dead. And that brings me to my last point. We've got running, crying, seeing, and this is where you come in. Because the more I thought about this, I thought, you know, your response to this story will define the rest of your life. Your response to this story will define the rest of your life. Now, John went in, and he saw the empty clothes, and it says he believed. I don't think he knew everything about why, because it says later, we didn't fully understand all the scriptures, but later on, I said, oh, yeah, this, okay, that had to happen. But he believed. He trusted God. Believe is essentially, I trust you. I trust you. I mean, not everybody had the same response because, you know, Jesus, again, was kept telling everyone, I'm going to die, the third day I'm going to rise. So you would have thought they would all shown up on the third day, but they didn't. They couldn't quite get it. But John believed, and then the others slowly did. And then he writes at the end of this chapter, he says, here's what I want you to do. He says, I have written this book. This is the same guy that went in and saw. He says, now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written. I picked these so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. He says, I wrote this book for the express purpose that you would know what happened and what Jesus did and that you might trust him. And if you trust him, you will have life. Now, this is where we all struggle, you know, with faith, what we believe. We spend all our time trying to figure out, is there a God? Is there what worldview, what philosophy do I want? And some people kind of blow it off, and some people go, you know, I'm just going to get to that when I'm old. I'm not sure what old is. It's almost like we get this feeling like, you know, when I'm old, I'll be able to flip the faith switch. You know, I'll give God the last pathetic years of my life that I got nothing else to do, right? You know, we kind of think that way. Or, you know, people go, well, you know, I don't know. The resurrection, that's a lot to believe in. But I like Jesus' teaching. I like Jesus the person. I like his teaching. I kind of pick and choose. I like he said, love one another. You know, that's good. I'm going to stay with that. I always thought it was summarized nicely by James Taylor. I'm a fan of James Taylor. 1970, came out with his first album, Sweet Baby James. And he wrote this song for his little nephew, who was also named James. He was a little baby, and so James Taylor wrote this as a waltz, and 3/4 time, and he said, and I'll sing it for you, okay, ready? Just seeing if you're still listening. There's a song that they sing when they take to the highway, a song that they sing when they take to the sea, a song that they sing of their home in the sky. Maybe you can believe it if it helps you to sleep, but singing works just fine for me. I thought that's how a lot of people feel, right? There's a smorgasbord of worldviews out there. Pick one, go with it. Pick one and just go with it if it helps you to sleep. See, we get very precise about everything else in our lives, about what we do, how we raise our kids, and what we do for a living, and all that kind of stuff. But we get very fuzzy when it comes to really important beliefs. And so somebody will deny the existence of God their whole life, and then they'll go to a funeral, and they'll go, well, she's in a better place. We get very fuzzy about stuff like that. Or the Charlie Brown philosophy that it doesn't really matter what you believe as long as you're really sincere. Really sincere. That sincerity does it, right? Not so much. Let me give you an example. Let's say that a couple of these lights are out, right? And we got to fix these two lights up here, right? And I've seen Ian up on one of these like ladders, and someday we'll call this the Ian Cook Memorial Auditorium, because he's going to fall down and die, and we'll just bury him right here. Because he said that would be okay. Because, you know, every time he goes on a mission trip, Ian, you know, he goes, and Ian's pretty old. Ask him how old he is. Because if you don't know Ian, you're thinking, well, he can do anything. But he just, if I die on the mission trip, just bury me right there. So anyway, Ian's always up on these things. I'm just look away. But let's say that there's these two lights, and let's say you got two ladders, right? And let's say one of the ladders is pathetic. It can't hold 10 pounds. It's rickety. It's not going to make it. You've got to go all the way up there on that ladder. And then you got another ladder that is like you bought the best thing Lowe's has to offer, you know, and it's got all these supports, and it can hold 500 pounds. There's no way it's coming down, right? But on the rickety old ladder, you've got somebody who just has a lot of faith, right? They're really trusted. They got this really strong trust in this ladder, right? On the other one, you got somebody who's kind of timid, right, on the good ladder. Which one's going to make it? It doesn't matter how much. The point is not the strength of your faith. The point is the strength of the ladder. The rickety ladder's not going to make it. It doesn't matter how much you believe in it. My point is, it's the object of our faith that makes all the difference. I actually heard a person say this once. They said if they found Jesus' body, it wouldn't change my faith. I go, what? Paul says, no. The Apostle Paul, back in 1 Corinthians 15 again, says, listen, If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, this is crazy. He said, if Christ hasn't been raised, your faith is futile. You're still in your sins. If only for this life we have hope in Christ, we are of all people most to be pitied. He says, if this didn't happen, this one thing, everything I'm saying is worthless. It's not like, Jesus had really good teaching and he wants us, so then that's a really good philosophy. No, he says, that's worthless. And he says, if the dead aren't raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we're going to die. Who cares about a philosophy? We're just going to die and just drink and eat all you want. Have fun because we're gone. He says, but Jesus did rise from the dead. I saw him. And that changes everything. So I was searching back when I was a kid. I was 18 years old. I was living at my parents' house. I was finishing high school, getting ready to go to college. And I'd looked at every philosophy and worldview and religion. I'd kind of gone through all of them, even though I was raised in a church. It didn't mean much to me. And then I finally got around to the whole thing and said, maybe I really need to take one more look at Jesus. So I started reading the Gospels, and I went, wait a minute. He's given me some ethical teachings, but mainly he's talking about himself. And that caught me off guard. I thought, oh, I think I've missed something big. The point is not do this, do that. The point is, who is Jesus? And did he die? And did he die for me? And did he rise from the dead? And is he alive now? And how have I responded to that? And I just knelt down. I'd been thinking about this for months and months. And just spontaneously one night in my room back in Indiana, I knelt down and I said, God, I want you in my life. I don't understand how it all works, but now I realize it's all about Jesus. And I'm a sinner. I screw up. I've broken every law, and I can't make myself better, and I need you to come into my life, and I can't earn it, so I hope this is by grace. And I found out that it is. It's a gift. And I said, I just want you in my life. And he comes into anyone's life who just says that. And you can say that right now. You can say, Jesus, I just want you in my life. I've screwed up. I can't fix myself. You're the one who came for me, and I believe in you. Let me pray, and in just a moment, some people that have believed are going to tell you their story, and we're going to celebrate their baptism. Let's pray. Jesus, we celebrate the truth of your resurrection. And we realize that our response to this story defines our lives. And if we're struggling with belief, help us. You're the Father who opens his arms wide and runs to us. You're the one who doesn't have too much time for our emotions. You're the one who's patient and comes to each of us in our own situation. You're the one who really lived and died and really is alive. And we worship you and thank you. In Jesus' name, amen.